The March of Time. This week's news fronts of the world, brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine.
The war in Germany.
Two eyewitness reports on how U.S. troops are smashing the Germans.
Modern living.
The kitchen of tomorrow to end all kitchens of tomorrow.
A soldier returns.
The story of a modern song of Bernadette.
The home front.
The first great step toward more post-war jobs taken yesterday in Washington by management and labor. Stand by for this week's news fronts of the world, brought to you by Time, the weekly news magazine, on the March of Time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Westbrook Van Forest speaking for the editors of Time magazine. This week, with U.S. armored divisions racing deep into Germany, a long simmering controversy reached a new peak. The question at issue, is the U.S. Sherman tank in the same class with its opponent, the German Royal Tiger? This week, Time magazine publishes a comparison of the General Sherman with the German Royal Tiger.
The German Royal Tiger weighs 75 tons. The American Sherman weighs 34 tons. The Tiger is 24 feet long. The Sherman is 20 feet long.
The Royal Tiger has tracks twice as wide as the Sherman's, therefore traverses mud more efficiently, can climb steeper grades. The Royal Tiger can straddle ditches 3.5 feet wider than can the Sherman.
The Royal Tiger's 88-millimeter gun can penetrate thicker armor than the Sherman's 76. The Tiger has thicker, better angled armor plate, is therefore harder to hit from in front.
On paper, the case for the German over the American tank seems pretty well proven. What about the men who fight in our armored divisions? For some weeks, war expert Hanson W. Baldwin of the New York Times has been summing up the evidence for and against the Sherman, quoting letters from U.S. Army tank men fighting in Europe. Wrote Staff Sergeant Ernest Holland, 2nd Armored Division.
We're just out-tanked and outgunned, that's all. It's mighty aggravating to let fly with everything you've got and just have the shells bounce off the front of the Jerry tanks.
Said Sergeant John Gozalski.
You can't go against a Tiger with a pea shooter.
Wrote Staff Sergeant Raymond E. Kusneri.
It's lucky we have so many tanks. That's the only way we can outmaneuver and outflank them.
Said Captain James Berth.
When the layman reads that we've knocked out twice as many Jerry tanks as they have of ours, he doesn't realize that it's not our tanks alone that did the job. It's tanks plus artillery plus planes plus guts.
Wrote a 2nd Lieutenant, platoon leader.
Whoever was responsible for supplying the army with tanks is guilty of supplying material inferior to its enemy counterpart for at least 2 years or more. During the time the Sherman has been standard, the Germans have developed 4 tanks superior to it.
But this week, as the Third Army rampaged halfway into southern Germany, Tank Master Lieutenant General George S. Patton flatly answered the criticisms of the U.S. medium tank. Said he,
the Third Army has always attacked, and therefore better than 70% of our tank casualties have occurred from dug-in anti-tank guns and not enemy tanks, whereas a majority of the enemy tanks put out have been put out by our tanks. I concede that if an American Sherman medium were to engage in a fixed-place duel with a Tiger, the medium wouldn't last. But the purpose of the American tank is not to engage in a slugging match, but to attack from the rear. With the advent of the heavy, cumbersome Tiger, the German, in my opinion, lost much of his ability in armored combat. In mechanical endurance and ease of maintenance, our tanks are infinitely superior to any other in this theater of war. Since the Third Army started fighting the Germans last August, German tank losses have been virtually double those of the Third Army. 2,287 to 1,186.
And so tonight stands the controversy over U.S. versus German tanks. The bitterest criticisms may be true. The Shermans may not be able to meet the Germans' monsters toe-to-toe yet. But this fact remains. In using Shermans as they were designed to be used for durability and fast open field running, General Patton is helping to win the greatest, fastest victory of the war. Time marches on. U.S. housewives have heard many a tall tale about the labor-saving wonders of the mechanical kitchen of tomorrow. Tallest tale and advertising gag of the week concerns the latest kitchen of tomorrow. In fact, one to end all kitchens of tomorrow, whenever that is. It eliminates its sponsors' claim all work. announced sales manager Sidney Mulliken and designer Thomas L. Hand of Cincinnati's Shable Company, manufacturers of plumbing fixtures.
Today's housewife will surely be tomorrow's kitchen wife. And will her life really revolve around the kitchen? Yes, it certainly will when she sits at the controls of our giant whirling faucet. With everything in easy reach, the old-fashioned floor will no longer have normal use. The floor is one enormous cup, a gigantic sink strainer.
Remembering that this is all in the spirit of fun, tonight the March of Time brings you an imaginary preview of Messrs. Mulliken and Hand's imaginary kitchen of tomorrow. Imagine a salesman of tomorrow knocking at the door, the old-fashioned kitchen door. He's equipped with a complete model of the kitchen of tomorrow.
Yes? What is it?
You may well ask, madam, what it is. It is a kitchen made entirely of glass, nylon, glass, plastic, synthetic rubber, and glass. It is completely prefabricated, shipped with one complete master plumber of tomorrow to connect it up.
Well, it sounds wonderful. How does it work?
Why, radar, of course, with a dash of electronics. There you'll sit in your kitchen, comfortable in a luxurious operator's booth, sealed off from noise, dirt, cooking odors, and also sealed off from the newest offspring in a self-rocking rocket cradle equipped with automatic diaper changer. Everything is within easy reach of your giant whirling 105-millimeter twin-spout water faucet.
Gee, and no floors to clean.
Exactly, madam. Drop the cup strainer floor 2 feet. Result, children's wading pool. Drop it 7 feet, adult swimming pool. Watch out for the automatic disposal button when swimmers are in pool, or quick freeze the pool for ice skating.
Ice skating in the kitchen? Oh, what'll they think of next? But it'll cost a plenty.
We'll come to that, madam. But first, remember, it's heated and cooled at no cost by BSR, bottled sun rays, and BCR, bottled cold rays. Warmth in winter and cool in summer are piped under floors and ceiling. Hot bottled sun rays heat water, which runs the power plant that makes electricity for the whole house. It even has a mood board.
Oh, is that some kind of a washboard of tomorrow?
Not at all, madam. Mood control regulates your frame of mind. A keyboard which selects movie scenes, music, fluorescent lighting, perfume. When your husband comes home, you can punch this key and get sympathy. This one and get generosity, or this one and get romance.
How much does it cost?
You spoke of the washboard. Here you can wash dishes, clothes, and the baby all at once. Put them in the cup strainer floor, push soapless suds button, turn giant faucet on full, and whirl.
I'll keep on washing the baby separate, thank you. He's a little too young for such a merry-go-round, and I'm too old.
As you wish, madam. But notice the compact built-in chemical garden. It raises pre-dehydrated fruit, vegetables, and even fish. Once a year, you dump the contents into a hopper, quick-seal it in tiny meal-sized capsules.
Capsule meals, indeed. How much does the whole thing cost?
Why, no more than the price of a good 6-room pre-war house.
I see.
Ah, but madam, you can use it as a complete post-war house and add rooms to the kitchen as your family and income expand.
Yeah. What are these buttons here?
A giant flit gun for pest control. This button, chloroform to capture robbers. This, a whiff of ether to send children to bed. And this, to get rid of nosy neighbors.
Okay, then if I punch all of them, I ought to be able to get rid of a salesman like you. Scram!
Thus, Shable & Company's Kitchen of Tomorrow, an absurdity, reminds U.S. housewives that things tomorrow won't be quite so different as some people may be expecting. Time marches on. Day before yesterday, as the German defenses on the Rhine cracked wide open, General of the Army Dwight D. Eisenhower declared that the German army was a whipped army. But, said he, it might yet organize for a stand when our forces halt temporarily for supplies to catch up with them. Despite official pronouncements, many an American has failed to realize that the speed of the war in Europe depends so heavily on history's most gigantic supply problem. For first-hand, detailed, and eyewitness knowledge of that problem, Time magazine recently sent its veteran correspondent, Ed Lockett, to the Western Front. He's just returned, and tonight is at the March of Time's Washington microphone. Come in, Washington. Go ahead, Ed Lockett.
I've just returned from a 4 weeks look at our supplies and our supply lines. I saw supplies move up fast when our present drive got underway. Army Service Force engineers were putting down railroad lines a matter of yards, literally yards behind the fighting and under shell fire. They were using some German rails just captured. Locomotives and freight cars loaded with supplies were already waiting to go. I learned just today that gasoline and oil pipelines are now stretched across the Rhine and well beyond. They and the railroads and the big trucks that thunder day and night over the black, chewed-up roads of the French and Belgian countryside are adding to the pipeline. Right now, at least, gas and oil are going up directly behind General Patton's tanks and behind the other tanks racing through Germany. Seaports, of course, are the real key to supplies in Europe. Today, the seaport is Antwerp, the port nearest the front lines. The Belgians are working for us there. We have to pay the Belgian stevedores what they call shiver money for working in danger, but they work. And our own army supply men, who don't get any shiver money, stay in there and work too. Red Cross supplies, some supplies for the French civilians, which help in our war effort, and the war supply overflow from Antwerp come into other ports also, Marseille, Cherbourg, and Le Havre. In Antwerp, when I was there, the Army Service Forces Transportation Corps was moving thousands of tons of supplies every day through this port, which the Germans had promised to make unusable with their V-bombs. The V-bombs were coming down by the dozen, both the rocket V-2 and the so-called buzz bomb V-1, but the port was working. Supply men were living and working in some areas where soldiers back for a rest out of the lines stayed one day and asked to go back to the front. From seaports further away from the front than Antwerp, the Transportation Truck Corps runs truck lines and a special railroad express called the Toot Sweet, which moves two trains a day out of Cherbourg and highballs to the lines with everything else sidetracked to give it a green light. This train has put supplies into the front lines less than 30 hours after they were landed in Cherbourg. Supplies are moving with our troops. Right now, the men with the guns up ahead are getting ammunition, food, and gasoline, the three absolute necessities for any advance. General Eisenhower says we may have to halt our drive towards Berlin at some point and temporarily wait for supplies. I think General Eisenhower is being cautious. I believe an unbroken supply line will follow the soldiers straight into Berlin.
Thank you, Ed Lockett. And now back to Westbrook Van Voorhis in New York.
Thank you, Ed Lockett. When the Allied soldier enters a conquered, badly bombed German city, he never knows what to expect of the German civilian. One may greet him with an alibi like this.
I didn't want to fight you. I hate the Nazis.
Another will be sullen and scowl and mutter.
You will get nothing from me. Nothing.
All too often the greeting is the whine of a sniper's bullet. Many and various are the moods of the conquered Germans, and these moods will determine not only the nature of the victory we will win, but also the spirit of the occupation we will have to maintain in the post-war years. And so this week, Time has sent Percy Knauth, a man who knows the German people well, to join Time's staff of correspondents on the European war front. His reports on the German state of mind will be based on what he sees and hears today, but they will have unique depth and understanding because of what he has seen and heard during the many years he spent in Germany, reporting the rise of Hitler and Nazism. Though American-born, Knauth speaks German with hardly a trace of accent, and Germans often tell him things they usually tell only to each other. His reports from captured frontline cities will be cabled to New York, where they'll be fitted by Time's experienced editors into the pattern of this global war. Then they will be written into Time as part of one straight, clear, connected story of the week's news of the war and the nearing peace of science, literature, art, and business. Thus do reports from Time correspondents on every front help Times editors every week bring you all the news that any intelligent American needs to know and understand. Five days ago, the 1st Allied Airborne Army of British and American paratroopers and airborne troops carried out its second great operation in Europe. In a matter of hours, they were over the Rhine River, joined up with supporting ground troops, cleaned the Germans out of another important strategic area. Among the war correspondents who jumped from the transports with American air troopers was Robert Kappa, veteran combat photographer for Life magazine. After taking many an action photograph soon to appear in Life, Kappa made his way back to Paris. Here is how Charles Wurtenbaker, Time magazine's chief military correspondent in Paris, cabled Kappa's story to Time's editors in New York. His account tells of the remarkable meal they ate together and preserves much of the Hungarian-born Kappa's unorthodox, often racy, style of describing his adventures.
Bob Kappa blew into my apartment in Paris last night about 9 o'clock with 2 days' growth of beard on his face. Still wearing a dirty paratroop uniform with a dirty brown sweater and a stocking cap on his head and his morphine strapped to his ankle. Said he hadn't eaten for 2 days. He was in luck, for I was just cooking some ham and eggs.
What? I'm hungry. I'm thirsty.
Well, how about some ham and eggs, Bob? And coffee?
Ah, you bet.
Okay, coming up. How's the operation?
Well, you know where this was the first invasion of my life where nobody was sick to their stomach. I waited for it, but nobody did it. We left from somewhere in France. It was very funny, the ride with this terrific armada over France and Belgium. It all looked like a string had been hung between France and Germany, and all the gliders hung onto it.
Here's some more ham and eggs. Bread and butter, too.
Oh, thanks, Bert. Well, 15 minutes before I had to jump, I started thinking over my life. I went over everything I ever ate and did, and I finished up in 12 minutes. I had 3 minutes left, and I was bored with myself, so I started to read a book. You got any cheese?
Here, try this, Bob. It's pretty good.
Thank you. Well, anyway, we dropped at 10:25, 4 miles north of the Rhine. Our plane was a lot hit before we got out of it, you know. The Germans had small arms and small anti-aircraft fire, but compared to the Normandy defenses, the defenses of the Rhine were definitely non-existent.
How about some cake, Bob, and some burgundy wine?
Pass it over, please.
Sure.
Thanks. Well, anyway, I jumped with 3 cameras and a canteen of scotch, and I pointed out to myself that the canteen was very important. The other guys jumped out yelling, "Umbriago," which is what you yell now. The moment between your jump and land is 24 hours in any man's life. I had time to figure out 6 or 7 things before I hit.
Had some more cheese and burgundy, Bob. What'd you figure out?
Well, one thing I figured out, Wirt, was that there is no future in this paratroops business. There were some paratroopers hanging in the trees. They were murdered by the Germans, shot 20 times. Somebody started shooting at me, and I started a beautiful long Hungarian swear. And the guy next to me said, "Hey, don't start those foreign players now. They won't do you any more good." Say, but have you got any...
Well, I was just going to ask you, how about some brandy?
Oh, wonderful. Here's my glass. It was 20 minutes before I had a chance to smoke, and it was 12:10 before I had a swig of whiskey. After that, well, we were busy all day. At 6:30, I finished and went to look for the command post. And on the way, I found General Matt Ridgway and Miley, the divisional commander, playing Indian. They were cleaning out the woods, you know, and crawling around on their hands and knees like they were lieutenants and having a lot of fun. Yeah, I went to bed in my parachute, and I dreamt that life said this was a fine story and I could go back to taking pictures of people skiing.
You were dreaming, Bob. Now, how's some champagne, huh?
We'll fill up this glass. You know, something worth... Much as I hate to make primitive statements, during an operation, the Germans are the meanest. And afterwards, they all have a cousin in Philadelphia. You know, that is what I like about the French. They don't have cousins in Philadelphia.
In this war, miracles of medical science have become almost commonplace. Unbelievable yesterday, amazing drugs and delicate operations save lives every day. But sometimes even doctors are baffled. Take the medically amazing case of tall, sandy-haired, 21-year-old Private William Myers of Greensburg, Pennsylvania. His story begins last July when the 7th Armored Division was pushing toward Paris. Private Myers was a machine gunner.
German artillery found the range of my group. I felt a big crashing in my head. From that moment, I was blind. I couldn't see a thing.
In a European-based hospital, Private Myers' left eye was removed, and he was returned to the U.S. Doctors exhaustively tested his right eye.
All right, look up, please.
Okay.
Down. Right. Left.
Well, Doc, what's the verdict?
Myers, I'm afraid you'll never see again. It's hopeless.
Private Myers went to the Valley Forge, Pennsylvania hospital. Began learning to read Braille, to walk with a white cane. One night he went to a party. At first, he didn't enjoy himself.
Hello, soldier. What's the matter?
Nothing. I'm all right.
You don't act like it, moping here in the corner.
I just don't feel like stepping out yet.
Oh, come on. You'll have to step out sometime with your girl.
Not with my girl. You don't know her. She's not stepping out with me. Made that clear enough.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You mean you pity me like she does?
No. No, I'm sorry you've lost your sight, but I don't pity you.
What's your name?
Bernadette. And if you're interested, I'm blonde and I have blue eyes.
Gee, Bernadette, I'll bet you're pretty.
Private Myers fell in love as quick as that. Then, needing additional plastic surgery, he was transferred to an Atlantic City hospital. Days and weeks passed slowly. A few days ago, his nurse was taking his temperature.
Open your mouth. Wide. Tongue out. There.
Oh, trying to say you're a shit.
I can't understand a word you say with that thermometer in your mouth.
I was only trying to say...
All right. Now, what is it?
I was only trying to say that you're a sad sight. What are you laughing at?
At your little joke, but as long as you can joke about your eyes, what's good for you?
Maybe.
You've got a visitor. She's waiting.
Show her in.
Very well. You may come in now.
Thanks.
Who are you?
Why, I'm Bernadette.
Well, you are blonde. And your eyes are blue.
Of course, silly.
And you are very pretty.
Oh.
But I mean it. I can see.
Now, Bill. Bill, you know what the doctor says.
Let him joke, miss, like the others. Sometimes it's morbid joking, but this time I think it'll make him feel better.
Yes, but... How many fingers am I holding up, darling?
Three.
What? I don't know what to think. Nurse!
Nice guessing, Myers. Doctor?
Yes?
Oh, I beg your pardon.
It's all right, nurse. Mrs. Myers and her daughter were just gone.
Well, then, doctor, we can't even hope for improvement?
I'm sorry, Mrs. Myers. Your boy will always be blind.
Yes. Goodbye, doctor. Thank you.
Goodbye. You wanted to see me, nurse?
I did, because I thought maybe Private Myers was seeing things today, but I guess I must be wrong.
Absolutely. His sight is entirely gone.
Come in. Hello, Mom. Hi, sis.
How are you, Billy?
Bill.
Hello there, Bernadette.
Hello.
We heard you were here with Billy, and we went to see the doctor a few minutes so you two could be alone.
Wait a minute, Bill. How did you know who it was when Mom and I came in that door?
Why, Bernadette must have told him, of course.
Well, no, I didn't know.
Sis, don't you ever wear anything but a black dress and that old red coat?
Why, who told you that?
Nobody told me. Can't you people get this straight? I can see.
Bernadette, sis... Maybe we'd better ring for the nurse or call the doctor.
Call the doctor? Nothing. I want to go for a walk along the boardwalk. I want to see the sights. People are looking at me, and I don't care.
But, Billy, I still can't believe it. You mean you can really see?
Isn't that a flag over there?
Uh-huh.
Why, yes.
Look at that Marine in full dress. With a girl in a blue coat. And that auto license is SE904, Connecticut.
Oh.
Now do you believe me?
Oh, yes. Yes, we believe you, darling. But well, just to make sure, let's go back and see the doctor, huh?
We'll see the doctor later. I haven't seen a movie in 8 months.
Said the hospital's eye doctor...
The Army considered Myers' case hopeless, but apparently the blindness in the right eye was hysterical blindness induced by shock. It was brought around by good surroundings and rest. Now it's as good as normal, perhaps a little better. His eyesight will never trouble Private Bill Myers again. He's a lucky man.
Time marches on. gravest threat to post-war jobs and the post-war living of all of us would be the deadly crossfire between bosses bent on smashing labor unions and unions bent on smashing America's free enterprise. Yesterday in Washington, D.C., three top leaders of U.S. business and labor signed a document. Their aim? To settle this post-war conflict before it breaks out. By a mutual recognition of management's right to manage without government interference and of labor's right to organize and bargain collectively. The signers of this new charter for labor and management, Eric Johnston, president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, William Green, president of the AFL, and Philip Murray, president of the CIO. The peace pact calls for a new national business labor committee to promote industrial understanding and cooperation. Tonight, a member of that committee is at our Washington microphone. He is Mr. E. J. Thomas, president of the Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Mr. Thomas.
To my mind, the greatest immediate importance of the Charter for Labor and Management lies in its implications and what promise it holds out to America in the post-war period of readjustment. What management and labor are saying in this charter is that two terrible wars are straining our foundations, that the victorious conclusion of these two wars must not bring the additional and possibly fatal strain of serious internal discord, that on the contrary, we must strive for a high degree of unity. The charter is general in its terms. In the long run, its importance will develop out of how its agreed-upon principles are put to work. It pledges recognition and the preservation of labor's right to organize and bargain collectively, of management's right and duty to manage, and of capital's right to a reasonable return. It asserts in clear terms that our system of private and competitive capitalism must continue to be the foundation of our peacetime economy. This does not promise that the post-war relations between employers and employees will be completely serene. We recognize that there will be differences in our viewpoints as to the application of principle. But the important thing is that in the areas of fundamental principle, we are in agreement and facing any post-war threat of social and political upheaval with the United Front. Now, what does all of this mean to the American public? Well, that remains to be seen. I believe, however, that it can mean greater security and higher standards of living. I believe that under the compulsion of competition, management and labor will have to strive for an expanding economy, for the production of more and better goods and services at prices within the reach of more and more people. In the thinking of the men who have drafted and signed this charter, labor and management serve one boss, the consumer. If we serve him well, he will reward us with his patronage. If we should seek to exploit rather than serve him, he will put us out of business. To succeed in serving the consuming public means giving them greater value, more goods made and sold, more jobs, an advancing standard of living, and improved working conditions. It means that capital invested in productive enterprise has an opportunity of securing a reasonable return. It means a happier, better fed, better clothed, better educated people. We are all of us in our several ways seeking to preserve America. Millions of our sons are doing it on the battlefields with bombs and bayonets. Those of us who build and manufacture do it with machines and goods. But what all of us have in mind is not simply the physical preservation of our country. We desire the preservation of those human values which are implicit in the word America. The freedoms, the opportunities, the equalities, and the democratic ideals which make for better human understanding among our people and a stronger and finer America. This charter offers a foundation upon which we can build to those objectives.
Time marches on!
Over the same network every afternoon at 4 o'clock.